communicate with their relatives next door. There was the large Hmong family who lived in a one-bedroom, second-floor apartment. The American couple who lived below them complained that their roof was leaking. When the landlord checked, he found the Hmong had all moved into the bedroom, covered the floor of the living room with a foot of dirt, planted vegetables, and watered them. Who knew whether these stories were true? In the climate that had fostered Frank's genial bigotry, did it matter? As a Hmong proverb puts it, all kinds of vessels can be plugged, but you can't plug people's mouths. Over the last century and a half, the Central Valley had involuntarily swallowed wave after wave of foreign-born settlers. Mexicans, Chinese, Chileans, Irish, Dutch, Basques, Armenians, Portuguese, Swedes, Italians, Greeks, Japanese, Filipinos, Yemenites, East Indians. Each had occasioned its own individually tailored flurry of xenophobia, of which the dumb Hmong stories were merely the most recent model. In the 1880s, the Anti-Chinese Association of Merced had served a similar defensive purpose, provoked by the Cantonese who had come to pan gold along the Merced River and lay tracks for the Central Pacific Railroad, and stayed to work in the brick factory near Bear Creek, and run fan-tan parlors along 14th Street. So had the Merced County Anti-Japanese Association, which had tried to expel Japanese farmers in the 1920s. So had Merced's 200-to-1 vote just before the end of World War II against permitting Japanese Americans interned in relocation camps to return to their old homes. I followed Frank's directions and crossed the tracks of the Southern Pacific Railroad, a freight line that parallels 16th Street in South Merced, which used to be Chinatown before it was raised in 1950 to make room for Highway 99. He was right. On the wrong side of the tracks, everyone was Hmong, the first Hmong I had ever seen. In front of the dingy two-story apartment buildings, coveys of children were chasing each other, kicking balls. They had learned soccer at Ban Vinai and playing tsu, a form of jacks in which pebbles are tossed and caught. The parking lots harbored more potted herbs than cars, and there were two community gardens as dense and green as vest pocket rainforests, stripped with rows of bok choy, bitter melon, and lemongrass. In a local grocery store, Shua Her and his wife Ye Muo sold 50-pound bags of rice, quail eggs, shredded squid, audio cassettes by local Hmong bands, sequins for decorating pandao, mentholated tape for treating headaches, sticky ointments for treating bruises, camphor balm for drying out fevers, and aromatic wood chips for making a tea that, as Ye Mo explained to me, flush out the bad dead blood after the lady have baby. I had no idea at the time, but I had landed in the most intensely Hmong place in the United States. Fresno and Minneapolis-St. Paul have larger Hmong populations, but Merced's Hmong constitute a far greater fraction of the local population. When I first visited Merced, the fraction, just as Bill Selvidge had promised, was 1/6. Now it is 1/5. That critical mass, as Bli Yao Mua put it, let's keep us more Hmong culture here than in Vientiane. Sometimes, I felt, that the other cities of the Central Valley, Fresno, Visalia, Porterville, Modesto, Stockton, Sacramento, Marysville, Yuba City, were mere suburbs of Merced. Hmong families constantly drove from city to city to visit relatives, and if they moved elsewhere in the valley, they returned to Merced for sub-clan gatherings, just as residents of satellite settlements in Laos had returned to their home villages. With 14 Hmong clans, Cheng, Fang, Hang, Her, Kong, Ku, Li, Lor, Muo, Tao, Vang, Vu, Zhang, and Yang represented in Merced, young people had no problem finding exogamous marriage partners. It was easy, even on short notice, to find a Xinning to negotiate with the pathogenic Da, an herbalist to concoct a healing tisane, a clan elder to mediate a dispute, or a Qing player to guide a dead person's soul back through the 12 heavens with his hauntingly resonant cluster of 6 steamed bamboo tubes. In Merced, where bamboo is hard to come by, Qings are sometimes made of PVC plumbing pipe. It is said that if the Qing player is good, the soul will have no trouble following the directions from the plastic. The anthropologist Eric Crystal once told a reporter for the Merced Sun-Star how extraordinary it was to hear the Hmong language spoken in the Kmart on J Street, when 15 years earlier it had been impossible to hear it anywhere in the Western world. Crystal is a former free speech activist who overflows with so many ideas and enthusiasms that he effervesces rather than converses. He has studied Merced's Hmong community, and he once curated a local exhibit of Hmong folk objects, bamboo vegetable baskets, opium harvesting knives, shamanic regalia. When I went to see Crystal in his office at UC Berkeley and told him I was living in Merced, he became so excited he started bouncing up and down in his chair. "You're so lucky," he exclaimed. "If I lived down in that place, I'd be running around with the Hmong every minute. I mean, I just love Merced. Not that the Hmong aren't a hassle. They are a huge hassle. When I first went down there, they were kind of hostile, you know? What the hell do you want? Who the hell do you think you are? Fuck off." The Mien are so delighted when anybody pays attention to them that they practically ask you to move in with them about 2 minutes after you sit down. The Cambodians are really happy if you show them that you are interested in Cambodia. But the Hmong, they just test you every minute. Once you pass the test, though, they are fantastic. The Hmong are one of the best organized, most focused groups you could find any place on Earth. They have the best leadership. They're the most able to cooperate among themselves. They're the most committed to preserving their ethnic identity. They're the most conscious of their own place in the world. You can see all that down in Merced. Those Hmong are really into being Hmong. The longer I spent in Merced, the more often I found myself asking, how in heaven's name could this have happened here? How could more than 10,000 villagers from the mountains of Laos possibly be living in a place that hosted the Yosemite Dental Society Smile Contest and the Rompin' Stompers Square Dance, that sent out welcome newcomer kits, which no Hmong ever requested, containing flyers for the Sweet Adeline Singers and the Senior Citizens Whittling Workshop, that awarded ribbons at its annual county fair for the best infant booties, best lemon pie, and best udder? In other words, as Frank had asked, why did they pick Merced? The answer to that question, as I gradually found out, boiled down to two words: Dang Mua. It is probably a good thing that Frank does not know Dang, the indefatigable grocer, interpreter, and pig farmer who had once been a clerk typist at the American Embassy in Vientiane. If Frank were to learn that from the Hmong point of view, Dang bears the same relation to Merced that Daniel Boone bore to Kentucky or the Pied Piper bore to Koppelberg Hill, he might not be properly grateful. On the other hand, Dang might impress him by his almost unbelievably sedulous pursuit of the American dream. The first time I walked into Dang's office at California Customs Social Services, the interpreting and liaison agency he had founded, he was on the phone. He was talking rapidly in Hmong, but every once in a while, when he collided with a concept for which there was no Hmong equivalent, he threw in an English term. Lack of communication, deposition, application, bank manager, conflict of interest. Dang was round-faced and sturdy, with the CEO's air of authoritative self-possession. He wore a large Casio watch that beeped and a large gold ring that said D. His business card was red, white, and blue. Commercial patriotism evidently ran in the family. His cousin, Mua Ki, whose office adjoined Dang's, supported his family largely by teaching Hmong about Christopher Columbus, Betsy Ross, and the advantages of the bicameral system in preparing for their naturalization exams. Although he raised sacrificial pigs, Dang was selective in his spiritual dogmas. For reasons of expedience, he had excluded Das. "I call myself a multi-religious believer," he explained. "I don't believe in ghosts because I like to be the boss of the ghost. And if you are afraid of the ghost is your boss." It was clear that no one would ever be Dang's boss but Dang. Dang Mua and his family used to live in Richmond, Virginia, where they were the only Hmong. The first time they saw snow there, soon after they arrived from Thailand in early 1976, Dang thought someone had come while they were asleep and sprayed all the trees with salt. He worked 18 hours a day, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. and 9 p.m. to 6 a.m., folding newspapers, a job that took little advantage of his five languages and made him so deep sleepy, as he put it, that he feared if he kept it up, "I notice I must be dead in 3 years." He earned $2.90 an hour. In his spare time, I have always wondered when that was, he went to the Richmond Library and read about prevailing climates, soil conditions, and crop yields in other states. His brother, who lived in Southern California, mentioned that the Central Valley had good weather and many different ethnic groups. Dang had heard through the Hmong grapevine that General Vang Pao was planning to buy a large fruit ranch near Merced, and that also influenced his decision. "So I go buy a white 1970 stick shift Hornet for $550, he recalled. "I tell my sponsor from the American church, tomorrow I will leave to California." He was very surprised. He say, "You know, it's a robbery. It's an earthquake out there. But I say my mind is made." So then he say, "You return that car and we will give you a V6 Cherokee." I say, "Thank you for that. But if I take your car, I owe you something." They were so mad. Next morning, I burn some jaw stick and pray for my ancestor to lead me for a safe trip. My sponsors say, "You don't need to do that. You should pray to the Lord." I say, "Your Lord let me have too many problems here in America. So I put a pan of water outside with some rice to pray to the God of the mountains, and my tears come. I never cry in my life, not even going to Thailand, and that was hell. But now I cry. I say, I'm small, but I am an adult person. I have to pursue now my plan." With the back end of his Hornet nearly scraping the ground beneath the trunk full of clothing, pots, pans, dishes, and a television set, and the front end sticking up so high he could barely see over the hood, Dang drove his family west for 2 days and two nights on Interstate 40, following the sun. He arrived in Merced with $34. It was mid-April 1977. The skies were so clear that he could see the Coast Range to the west and the Sierras to the east. The air was sweet with almond blossoms. In midsummer, Merced is an oven, and in the winter, a chilling fog blows off the reservoir whose resident Da, according to Fu, once caught her and followed her home. But in the spring, as Steinbeck's Jodes were told, as they approached the Great Green Expanse, after making a journey much like the Moses, the Central Valley is the purtiest goddamn country you ever seen. There were miles and miles of ripe peaches and figs, which Dane got a job picking, and jackrabbits and squirrels he could easily trap for dinner. The town itself was clean and quiet, with an orderly grid of streets laid out by the Central Pacific Railroad in 1872. There were no beggars or derelicts. Flat as a bowling green and 167 feet above sea level, Merced was in some ways an outlandish address for a mountaineer, but it was better than Richmond, and it was incalculably better than the slums of Hartford and Detroit, where some of Dane's clanspeople lived. Most people drive through Merced en route from one place to another, Sacramento to Bakersfield, San Francisco to Yosemite. But to Dane, worn beyond weariness by the journey from Laos to Thailand to Virginia to California, it was the long-desired terminus. Vang Pao's plan to buy the fruit ranch failed, partly because the County Board of Supervisors had public misgivings about the refugees it might attract, and partly because the general had an inauspicious dream the night before he was to sign the contract. Nonetheless, the favorable buzz about Merced and the rest of the Central Valley had already spread to discontented Hmong communities across the United States. A trickle, and then a flood, of dilapidated cars began to stream in from the east. "It was just wild," recalled Eric Crystal. "You see these Arkansas plates and stuff on the streets. I mean, they were just pouring in from all over the place. Merced is incredible now, but it was particularly incredible then." It is doubtless easier to wax enthusiastic about the Hmong of Merced if you are a visiting anthropologist than if you are a resident taxpayer. "Suppose a fella got work and saved. Couldn't he get a little land?" Tom Joad had asked, and he was told, "You ain't gonna get no steady work." So it was with the Hmong who couldn't get the high-end agricultural jobs because they had no English and no experience, and couldn't get the low-end ones because Mexican migrants had already filled them. At first, the Merced Sun Star treated the newcomers like exotic guests, though it was chary of printing the word Hmong, which could be found in no atlas or dictionary. Local reporters called the Hmong Laotians. Dang Moore's five languages were a local dialect, Laotian, Thai, French, and English. Soon, however, the Hmong, for whom the code word became refugees, started to make headlines. "Refugees drain limited services. Refugee students jam the schools. Supervisors ired by meager state funds allocated for refugees. More dollars needed for refugees." More dollars were needed because of an economic catastrophe that began in Merced in the early 80s and continues today. Merced was never rich. During the last three decades, it has ranked between number 35 and number 53 of California's 58 counties in per capita income. It was limping along comfortably enough, however, until the Hmong came, an event that happened to coincide with a nationwide recession as well as deepening cutbacks in both federal and state social programs. 79% of the Hmong in Merced County, as compared with 18% of the county's other residents, received public assistance. By 1995, Merced had achieved the unwanted distinction of having a greater fraction of its population on welfare than any other county in the state. The federal government picks up half of the welfare costs, the state picks up 47.5%, and the county picks up 2.5%. That 2.5% sounds like a pittance, but in recent years, it has amounted to nearly $2 million annually, 2.5 times as much as it was in 1980, to which is added nearly $1 million in administrative costs. While scrambling to meet its other financial obligations, the county has found those millions by closing 3 libraries, ceasing to maintain 21 of its 24 parks, leaving 5 sheriff posts vacant, increasing the caseloads of all 6 of its judges, reducing the staff of its probation department, reducing road maintenance, cutting the budget for arts and culture, recreation, senior citizens' programs, and veterans' services, and transferring all of its fire departments to the State Department of Forestry. The welfare reform bill, if it is not revised, will only make matters worse by forcing the county, which is unlikely to let its residents starve, to make up for at least some of the evaporated federal funds. I asked a county social worker what would happen if neither the bill nor the demographics of Merced's population were to change. Bankruptcy, she said. Of course, the Hmong are not solely or even primarily responsible for Merced's fiscal crisis. Merced has plenty of white and Hispanic welfare recipients. They occasion less notice and less resentment than the Hmong because although their numbers are large, their percentages are small. That is, most of the Hmong are on welfare and most of the members of Merced's other ethnic groups are not. And although welfare has become the most conspicuous focal point for public rage, Merced County has been simultaneously strained by several other, more expensive problems. The accelerating transfer of agricultural work from people to machines. Double-digit unemployment, about three times the national level. Almost every month since 1980, the 1995 closing of Castle Air Force Base, which has provided more than 1,000 jobs to local residents, and a 1992 restructuring of California sales and property taxes that returned more to the state and less to the county. The crucial distinction is that you cannot see a restructured property tax, but when you drive down almost any street on the south side, you can certainly see the Hmong. In a county where 7 out of 10 people voted for Proposition 187, California's 1994 referendum to ban public services to illegal immigrants, even legal immigrants are unlikely to be received with open arms. That is not to say that everyone in Merced grumbles about the Hmong. The local churches have always treated them generously. And a small but fervent core of well-educated professionals, most of them liberal transplants from other cities, concur with Jeff McMahon, a young reporter at the Sun Star who told me, "The one thing that makes Merced different from every other dusty little town in the Central Valley is that there are so many Southeast Asians here. Their culture is a blessing to this community. How else would Merced ever earn a place in history?" The Sun Star now features a cultural diversity page, and the tourist brochure distributed by the Merced Chamber of Commerce includes, next to pictures of the county courthouse and the local wildlife museum's stuffed polar bear, a photograph of a smiling Hmong woman, albeit dressed in a Lacoste polo shirt, holding a dazzlingly green armful of lettuce and string beans. Especially during the 80s, when the Hmong were novel and exciting, many of Merced's women rallied to their cause. Volunteers in the Befriend a Refugee program took Hmong families to the Applegate Zoo and invited them to backyard barbecues. Dan Murphy's wife, Cindy, taught Hmong women how to use sewing machines and self-cleaning ovens. Jan Harwood, a 4-H club youth advisor, organized a course, locally referred to as the Tidy Bowl class, to train Hmong women for housekeeping jobs. Jan's interpreter, a man named Pa Vu Tao, was so impressed by the enthusiasm with which she demonstrated the use of Lysol, Comet, and Spick and Span that when Jan broke her leg, he reciprocated by gathering moss from the 4-H camp's trees and teaching her how to make an herbal compress to reduce the swelling. The warmest welcome I ever saw the Hmong receive was a naturalization ceremony held in the boardroom of the Merced County Administrative Building, in which 18 Hmong, as well as 2 Lowland Lao, 9 Mexicans, 5 Portuguese, 3 Filipinos, 2 Vietnamese, 2 Indians, a Thai, a Korean, a Chinese, an Austrian, and a Cuban became American citizens. Each received a copy of the Constitution, a history of the Pledge of Allegiance, a picture of the Statue of Liberty, a congratulatory letter from the President of the United States, a little American flag, and courtesy of Lodge Number 1240 of the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks, unlimited free soft drinks. Standing next to a mounted copy of the Merced County Song, "We are known for sweet potatoes and milk and chickens too, tomatoes and alfalfa, and almonds great to chew," Judge Michael Hyder told the assembled multitude, many of whom could not understand a word but listened respectfully nonetheless, "We've all come together from many places to form one great country, including myself, for my father was a naturalized citizen who came from Lebanon. In America, you don't have to worry about police breaking down your doors. You can practice any religion you want. There's such complete freedom of the press that our newspapers can even attack our leaders. If the government feels they need your land, they cannot just take it away from you. Most importantly, every one of you has the same opportunity as the person sitting next to you. My father never could have dreamed that his son would be a judge. Your children can be doctors. I just get carried away when I talk about how wonderful it is to be a citizen of the United States. Congratulations, you're one of us." But while I was listening to Judge Hyder, I thought of a conversation I had had not long before with Dr. Robert Small, the unfalteringly opinionated MCMC obstetrician whose views are shared by a large segment of Merced's population.
"I and my friends were outraged when the monks started coming here," he told me. "Outraged. Our government, without any advice or consent, just brought these non-working people into our society. Why should we get them over anybody else? I've got a young Irish friend who wants to get a U.S. education and wants to work. He can't get in. But these Hmong just kind of fly here in groups and settle like locusts. They know no shame being on the dole. They're happy here."
When I mentioned the high rate of depression among Hmong refugees, Dr. Small said,
"What do you mean? This is heaven for them. They have a toilet they can poop in. They can drink water from an open faucet. They get regular checks, and they never have to work. It's absolute heaven for these people, poor souls."
I had also spoken with the more temperate John Cullen, director of the Merced Human Services Agency, which administers public assistance. "Merced has been a fairly conservative, WASPy union for many years," he said. "The other nationalities that are part of our community came here over a long period of time, but the Hmong came in one big rush. They were a jolt to the system. This inevitably causes more of a reaction. And they do take more than their share of the county's income. You can't deny that the county has been seriously, seriously impacted. I think Merced's reaction to the Hmong is a matter of water swamping the boat, not a matter of racism." On occasion, however, it is a matter of racism. One day, Dang Moa was walking out of his grocery store, the Moa Oriental Food Market, when a man he had never seen before drove by and started yelling at him. "He is maybe 40-year-old person," recalled Dang. "He is driving 84 Datsun. He say to me, 'Shit, man, why you come to this country? Why didn't you die in Vietnam?' Well, my father always say to me, 'If someone act like a beast to you, you must act like a person to him.' So I try to smile and be nice. I say, 'I'm a citizen just like you are.' I say, 'Give me your phone number. You come to my house and eat Hmong food and we talk 2 or 3 hours. But he run away. Maybe he is a veteran, and he convinced I am enemy." Dang's hypothesis is not as far-fetched as it sounds. Many people in Merced have confused the Hmong with the Vietnamese, including the former mayor Marvin Wells, who once informed a Chamber of Commerce luncheon that the Vietnam refugees in California were a problem. It is not uncommon to hear the Hmong called boat people, although Laos is landlocked and the only boat most Hmong are likely to have seen was the bamboo raft on which they floated, under fire, across the Mekong River. At least the real boat people, the former South Vietnamese, were United States allies. A more unsettling assumption was revealed by the MCMC maintenance man who, conflating the Hmong with the Viet Cong, told Dave Schneider that the hospital was patronized by too many fucking gooks. Over and over again, the Hmong here take pains to explain that they fought for the United States, not against it. Dang Mua is a one-man public relations outfit, constantly hauling out an old National Geographic with a picture of his uncle in a military uniform, or popping a videotape of the Armée clandestine into his VCR. One man from a nearby Central Valley town made sure that even after his death, there could be no mistake about his past. His tombstone in the Toll House Cemetery northeast of Fresno, where dozens of Hmong reminded of Laos by the hilly topography, chose to be buried until local residents started complaining about their loud funerals, reads, "Beloved father and grandfather, Chua Cha Cha, April 20th, 1936, February 27, 1989. He served for the CIA from 1961 to 1975. In 1994, there was a demonstration in Fresno by Hmong welfare recipients, many of whom were former soldiers, protesting a new requirement that they work 16 hours a week in public service jobs, which they called slavery. Like older Hmong across the country who still believed in the promise, the CIA's alleged compensation contract, they assumed that aid with no strings attached was no more than their proper due. They expected the Americans to be grateful for their military service. The Americans expected them to be grateful for their money, and each resented the other for not acting beholden. In the director's conference room at the Merced Human Services Agency, there hangs a huge pandao that tells the story of the end of the war in Laos. In a series of embroidered and appliqué images, Hmong families try to crowd into four American airplanes at Long Tien, walk to Thailand carrying huge loads on their backs, attempt to swim across a wide river, settle in Ban Vi Nai, and finally, load their belongings onto a bus that will take them to an airplane bound for the United States. Across from the pantao, there is a computer from which the welfare files of thousands of Hmong can be accessed. The Lees, like many Hmong families whose records have been kept here, are intimately familiar with the grief chronicled by the pandao, but oblivious to the anger induced by the computer files. When I asked Phua and Nakao how they felt about being on welfare, Phua said, "I am afraid the welfare will go away. I am afraid to look for a job because I am afraid I could not do it. I am afraid we would not have food to eat." Nakao said, "In Laos, we had our own animals, and our own farm, and our own house. And then we had to come to this country, and we are poor, and we have to have welfare. And we have no animals and no farm. And that makes me think a lot about our past." Neither of them said a word about what Americans might think of them for not working. For them, that was not the issue. The issue was why the American war had forced them to leave Laos and, via a reluctant trajectory that would have been unimaginable to their parents or their parents' parents, wind up in, of all places, Merced. Sometimes I felt that the Hmong of Merced were like one of those visual perception puzzles. If you looked at it one way, you saw a vase. If you looked at it another way, you saw two faces. And whichever pattern you saw, it was almost impossible, at least at first glance, to see the other. From one angle, The welfare statistics look appalling. From another, it was possible to make out small but measurable signs of progress, that during the past decade, despite the periodic arrival of new JOJs from Thailand, the public assistance rate had declined by 5%. More than 300 graduates of government-funded job training programs were now operating sewing machines, making furniture, assembling electronic components, and working in their local industries, that dozens of local Hmong women had started taking English classes following a 1995 change in federal welfare regulations, a warm-up to the 1996 bill that required both parents in intact families to study or work unless there was a child under three or a disabled family member at home. The requirement to work would be more effective if Merced actually had jobs. When you looked at the Merced school system, what you saw again depended on your point of view. From one perspective, the Hmong children, who multiplied at a rate that made Dr. Small just shake his head and keep muttering the word contraception, were a disaster. In order to relieve overcrowding and to desegregate schools that would otherwise be almost entirely Asian, Merced has had to bus nearly 2,000 of its elementary and middle school students, build three new elementary schools, a new middle school, and a new high school, teach classes in more than 70 trailers, and, while waiting for them to arrive, in cafeterias, on auditorium stages, and in the exhibition hall of the county fairgrounds, and switch seven schools to a staggered all-year calendar. On the other hand, Hmong children rarely caused disciplinary problems and regularly crowded the honor rolls. Four of the Lee children received their class's Student of the Month awards. Rick Ubner, who taught May Lee's 8th grade language arts class, once wrote me a letter that described May as a leader among her peers and a clear-thinking, confident person, he continued. Almost exclusively, the Hmong are hard-working, quick-learning students. Their parents are eager to attend conferences in spite of language barriers. On many occasions, students have acted as interpreters for their parents and me. Typically, the parents thank me for teaching their child and ask if he or she is working hard enough, wonder if there is any problem with the child showing proper respect, and inquire if there is anything that they can do at home to help. At a conference I attended on college and career planning for Hmong teenagers, Jonas Vengay, standing under a sign that said, "Education, the key to your future," told his almost preternaturally quiet audience, "In America, even when the child is in the stomach, the mother thinks about books and pencils. Your parents grew with knife or hammer or tool. They cannot help you. Let your book be your best friend. For if you cannot learn in school, whose fault is it? Who is to blame?" No one said a word. "Answer me," thundered Jonas. Finally, in a small voice, a boy said, "Yourself?" "Right," said Jonas. "Do not be afraid. If you are a chicken boy or chicken girl and you keep quiet, the examination will come and you will fail. Those who cannot learn cannot be successful. We want you to be successful in the year 2000. There was silence in the room. Then the students burst or crept into muted applause. Although many Hmong teenagers in Merced are as wholesome and deferential as those in Jonas's audience, a few have joined the Men of Destruction, the Blood Asian Crips, the Oriental Lokes, or one of the other gangs, which, in a perverse distortion of group ethic, started spreading through the Central Valley in the mid-80s. Merced has black and Hispanic gangs as well, but local police officers agree that the Hmong gangs are the most likely to carry guns and the most likely to use them. I occasionally heard mutterings about Hmong gangs, but local residents who disliked the Hmong seemed to be far more obsessed with smaller, stranger crimes. I was told countless times that the Hmong kidnapped underage brides. I also heard that they smuggled drugs. The local police department confirmed that opium had been found inside axe handles, picture frames, bamboo chairs, tea bags, and packages of noodles. There were also many tales about fish and game violations. The Merced Sun Star ran an article about Hmong who poached bass from the San Luis Reservoir with 1550-foot set lines, drove deer into ambushes by banging on pots and pans, and served stewed pied bilgrebe for dinner. None of these stories was false, but they were all partial. Left out of the telling were all the extenuating circumstances. That Hmong marriage customs had a cultural context unfamiliar to Americans. That opium smuggling was uncommon, and most of the contraband was intended for medicinal use by the elderly. That in Laos, all the hill tribes had hunted and fished without rules, seasons, or limits. And that once they reached adulthood, the Hmong here, as in other parts of the country, had a low overall crime rate compared with other people below the poverty line. The most frequent accusation I heard was that the Hmong were terrible drivers. They seemed fine to me, so I went to the Department of Motor Vehicles and asked John McDonnell, the manager, what he thought. He said, "In many respects, I am happy to have these people as neighbors, but as far as driving ability goes, well, that's another matter. Violations of pedestrian right-of-way, going through stop signs, not realizing their speed, all errors of judgment. Also, when they come to get their licenses, some of them cheat on the written test." "How do they cheat?" I asked.
"They sew," said Mr. McDonnell.
"They sew?" Mr. McDonnell, who wore trifocals and looked a little like Ed Wynn, opened the top left drawer of his desk.
"Well, the ones who don't know English can't read the questions, and they answer at random and take the corrected answer sheets home and compare them with their friends. Some of them just memorize the dots on the page. 5 different tests, 46 questions, 3 answers. Let me see. 46 times 15 is 690 dots. They're very good at memorization, but that's an awful lot of dots. So quite a few of them bring in these little cribs."
He reached in the drawer and took out an eyeglass case. In flawless cross-stitch, a different color for each of the test's 5 questions, a Pandao artist had sewn microscopic X's to indicate whether, for each question, the correct answer was the first, second, or third option. Next, he took out a checked coat. On each lapel, certain squares had been blocked in with thread. Next, he took out a striped pullover with almost invisible white stitches down the front and along each sleeve. Next, he took out a white shirt with minute blue stitches on the cuffs. "Real neat work, isn't it?" he said admiringly. I concurred. Then I asked, "What do you do when you catch someone using one of these?"
"He fails the test and we confiscate the crib."
It occurred to me that an awful lot of Hmong must exit from the Department of Motor Vehicles wearing fewer clothes than when they walked in. Late that night, I lay on the floor of Bill Selvage's study where I was staying. Next to my sleeping bag, I had taped photographs of Hmong. Hmong children from the National Geographic wearing pandao, Hmong teenagers from the Merced Sun Star wearing jeans, the Lee family wearing slightly off-kilter American clothes in pictures I had taken myself. I found them all very beautiful, and I often stared at them for hours when I couldn't sleep. That night, for some reason, the phrase differently abled, a substitute for disabled, that had enjoyed a brief vogue among progressive journalists, kept buzzing around in my head. I had always disliked the term, which struck me as euphemistic and patronizing. Suddenly, I realized why it was keeping me awake.
I had been trying all day to decide whether I thought the Hmong were ethical or unethical. And now I saw it. They were, in this case, as was a supremely accurate phrase, differently ethical. The Hmong, it seemed to me, were abiding in spades by E.M. Forster's famous dictum that it is better to betray one's country than one's friend. Since they had never had a nation of their own and had been persecuted by every nation they had inhabited, they could hardly be expected to harbor an extravagant respect for national jurisprudence. Rules and regulations were particularly breakable if they conflicted with the group ethic, which, after all, is an ethic, not just an excuse to flout someone else's ethic. Hmong folktales are heavily populated with characters clearly meant to be perceived as virtuous, who lie to kings, dragons, das, and other authority figures in order to protect their families or friends. I had heard innumerable modern versions in which some synecdochical representative of the U.S. government had played the role of righteously deceived da. In the Thai camps, Hmong had claimed their children were older than they really were so they could receive larger food allotments, claimed their parents were younger than they really were because it was rumored that the United States considered old people undesirable, and told immigration officials that collateral relatives were members of their immediate families. In the United States, they had claimed their children were younger than they really were so they could stay in school longer, lied to doctors in order to get disability benefits, claimed they had separated from a spouse in order to increase the family's welfare allowance, and among the younger generation, let friends copy their schoolwork. Not all the Hmong I knew had done these things. Most had not. But those who had were unashamed. In fact, the ones who had lied to immigration officials had been amazed. When they reached the United States and discussed their experiences with their American sponsors to find that their behavior was regarded as unethical. What would have seemed unethical, in fact unpardonable to them, was leaving their relatives behind. Nikhao Lee, who couldn't read a word of English, had passed his driving test in precisely the manner John McDaniel had described, by memorizing where to place the X's on his answer sheet. He had been asked to make a set of prescribed pencil marks. He had done so. In fact, his success on the test, which seemed to him a purely technical challenge, not an assessment of his ability to drive safely, was a triumph of intelligence over bureaucracy. However, it never would have occurred to him to go to so much trouble if he had been able to pass the test by conventional methods. Not long after my conversation with John McDaniel, the California Department of Motor Vehicles instituted oral and written tests in Hmong, and the rate of cheating among Hmong applicants declined to a level comparable with that of Merced's other ethnic groups. Nikhao viewed his driver's license as a matter of patent necessity. How else was he to visit his relatives? The family came first, then the clan, then the Hmong people, and everything and everybody else ranked so far below these three that it would have been blasphemy to mention them in the same breath. I believe the Nikhao, like most Hmong, would rather die than deceive a member of his family or clan. The group ethic enabled Nikhao not only to pass his driving test, but to make unequivocal decisions in every sphere of his life, to assess people's characters with confidence, and to operate almost entirely within the supportive Hmong community rather than within the larger and harsher world of America. On a larger scale, the exigent pull of ethnic solidarity was what made the Hmong so open-handed, so good at teamwork, and so warm. But it seemed to me that, especially for the community's educated leaders, the obligation to put the group before the self also had some negative consequences. Stress, loss of privacy, a punishing sense of responsibility. Nikau's age and his lack of English insulated him from the conflicts and ambiguities of having one foot in one culture and one foot in another. His life is not joyous, though at least clear. This was not the case with the Hmong who shared high status in both the Hmong and American communities. Dang Muo was an exception. He had so much forward momentum that stresses and doubts simply flowed off him like water from a torpedo. Also, although Dang spent many hours doing what nearly all literate, English-speaking Hmong of his generation did, deciphering other people's junk mail, filling out their tax forms, telephoning agencies, translating notes from school, he charged for these tasks. Most Hmong did them for free. I heard about one multilingual woman, once a nursing administrator in Siang Kuang province, who had worked as a Hmong liaison after settling in Minnesota. She became so exhausted by the incessant demands of the Twin Cities' Hmong community, both during and after work hours, that she moved to Merced without telling her clan and got a job that allowed her to deal only with Americans. "Don't call her," I was told. "She's trying to lie low." Family loyalty, the group ethic, concentrated to an even more potent form, also had its downside. Pa Vu Tao, the interpreter who had made an herbal compress to heal Jan Harwood's broken leg, told me he had once been offered a lucrative job at UC Davis. He had turned it down, with regret but without hesitation, after his father, angry that Pa Vu would even consider leaving his relatives in Merced, asked him, "Does money mean more, or does the family mean more?" In the early 70s, out of more than 300,000 Hmong in Laos, there were only 34, all men, who were studying at universities overseas. Two of them had resettled in Merced, Blia Yao Muo and Jonas Vangay. Both had won scholarships to the Yisei National, Vientiane's most elite secondary school, and had obtained bachelor's and master's degrees from French universities. Jonas left a job as a computer analyst in a Paris suburb to immigrate to the United States in 1983, just after the largest wave of Hmong refugees, most of them illiterate farmers like the Lees, had been admitted. Blia came the same year, leaving an executive position at an international packaging company. "I move here to help because it was my moral responsibility," he told me. "If my generation stay in France, we would feel guilty." Blia and Jonas were more intellectually cosmopolitan not only than every Hmong they knew, but also than every American they knew, including myself. Their leadership roles in Merced had earned both of them respect, but little money, and as far as I could see, little peace of mind. I knew Blia Yao Muo best. There was a period of a few months when I spent almost every afternoon sitting in his office, a windowless cubicle with fake wood paneling, asking questions about Hmong religion, military history, medical practices, kinship patterns, weddings, funerals, music, clothing, architecture, and gastronomy. It was from Blia that I learned, for example, that if I wronged another person, I might be reborn in my next life as my victim's buffalo and used for farm work. That what American doctors called the Mongolian spot, a bluish birthmark on the buttocks of many Asian babies, was in fact the place where the babies had been spanked, in utero, by a da, and that the shoes Hmong corpses wore for burial had upturned toes. Blia looked like a frayed aristocrat, with a high-domed forehead and finely drawn features. Although he was almost exactly my age, in his mid-30s when we first met, I always felt like a child in his presence, partly because I sat in a chair with a tiny desk attached, the way that I had in sixth grade, and partly because he knew so much more than I did and was so patient with my ignorance. I remember countless occasions after I had asked him to provide a rational explanation for a non-rational custom, when he just shook his head gently and said, "Anne, may I explain to you again? The Hmong culture is not Cartesian." Blia was the executive director of Lao Family Community, a mutual assistance organization that helped Merced's Hmong community negotiate the public assistance labyrinth, apply for job training, resolve community conflicts, and keep abreast of news from Laos and Thailand. It was quartered in an old truck depot near the Kmart. Signs on the wall next to Hmong language handouts on fair housing laws and disability insurance said, "Please help yourself out," and "You may wanted news." The Hmong community might not always meet the expectations of the American community, but it certainly knew how to run itself. Blia once drew me a flowchart, which was Cartesian, delineating how his organization worked. "At the top is the president and advisory board of 8, he explained, "then 11 board of director, then 17 district leaders, then our 6,000 members. Let us say we need $100 to help out person who will be evicted. The 17 district leaders carry the news and everyone donate 5 cents or 10 cents. Tomorrow we get that money. Or if one person die, tomorrow money will flow back to help that family. If there is change in welfare rules, we get out information the same way. If someone have problem with their child, we can solve problem inside Hmong community before it gets to the police. This way, 6,000 people we can serve with 4 or 5 working in our office, no problem. No problem, that is, if those 4 or 5 people had no private life whatsoever." Blia's eyes were often puffed and bloodshot from lack of sleep. Once he came to work, after staying up all night mediating between the Merced police and a Hmong family who, while bringing a sacrificed pig home from Fresno, had had a traffic accident that distributed parts of the pig across the northbound lanes of Highway 99. He spent another night dealing with 3 teenaged girls who had run away from their homes in Fresno and stolen some money from an uncle in Merced. After persuading the uncle not to report the theft to the police, Blia took the girls home, woke his pregnant wife, and asked her to cook them a meal while they waited for their parents. The parents were not grateful. "They are angry because I should have acted more severely," he told me. "I did not know until they arrived, but I am related to those families by my clan and my wife's clan. That is terrible. In our culture, this means I have the same duty as parents to give the children a lesson. I should have spanked them. I did not do my right duty." I saw Blia's face light up only once, the time he described an ambitious housing scheme he had conceived. "I would like to share with you what we are dreaming of for the future," he said. "Some of us hope to establish a Hmong town on the other side of Childs and Girard Avenues. If we can make the financial package to buy this land, we can build 200-300 houses. The Hmong house in Laos has a cross like an X at the top. We can do that here too. Each family can have a small garden. We can have our own Hmong shopping center. Our Hmong town will boost morale because people will take good care of it. We will lose face if a white person is seeing that Hmong town is dirty. Having our own town will help Hmong people to become more economically self-sufficient. If this dream can come true, this will be very good for Hmong image. But when I came back to Merced a year later, no one had heard of Hmong town, and Blia had resigned from his job at La Family Community and was selling insurance door to door. An American who knew him told me, "Blia is the most burned out Hmong I ever saw." He later moved to St. Paul, Minnesota, where he counsels Asian students and teaches a course on Hmong culture at Metropolitan State University. His telephone number is now unlisted. Like Blia, Jonas Vangay translated, mediated, counseled, and interceded on 24-hour call. At the end of his speech at the college and career conference I had attended, Jonas had told his teenaged audience, "Call me any time during the day or night." And I knew that he would be taken literally. He had heavy family responsibilities as well, explaining to me once why his family shared their home with 2 of his brothers, one of whom had 9 children, he said, "I have another brother who is very American now. He refused to accept our brothers to live with him. He say, 'Here in the United States, it is everyone for himself.' I say,